Welcome to Inside the Rope, the podcast where we speak to the leading minds in wealth management. Now, long listeners to the podcast will recognise our guest today being Tim Carlton, who featured in episode number 9 and 53, dating back to 2018 and 2020. Tim's certainly been a good friend to the show. The performance of his fund, the AusCap Long Short Fund, has been exceptional, with a compound annual growth rate of 15.8% since inception, being up 22% the last year and up 15.3% per annum over the last 5 years. We talked to Tim about his thoughts on ResMed and the threat potentially posed to that company through GLP-1 and Ozempic. We talk about lithium and his views on that. We touch on China. We also talk about his holding in the Charter Hall Retail REIT. We also quickly touch on crypto and AI towards the end of the podcast. Please remember to keep your feedback coming. You can email me at david.clark@codacapital.com. You are encouraged to listen to the disclaimer at the end of the podcast and reminded that this episode is recorded for entertainment and information purposes only. It is not advice. And of course, people considering any financial investments are always encouraged to seek advice and read all offer documents. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. Please share it, post feedbacks, tell your friends. We really enjoy that sort of feedback. Enjoy the episode. Tim Carlton, welcome back to Inside the Rope.
Thanks, David. Great to be here.
Tim, it's been, you're a veteran of the podcast, and long-term listeners, let alone first-time callers, will recognize your dulcet tones from episode 9 way back in 2018 and episode 53 in 2020. So a long-term friend of the show. Thanks for coming back. For those listeners who haven't heard from you before or don't have the time as they're on the ferry or out running or walking the dog, whatever they're doing while listening to us, please give them a brief intro to yourself.
Yeah, sure. So I run a business called AusCap Asset Management. We are an equities manager focused on Australian shares. We've been in operation since 2012. I'm the chief investment officer. And we are a quality and value investor. What does that mean? Well, we're looking for great businesses. Great businesses have unusual attributes. They have an ability to earn more per dollar invested than a lot of the other companies around them. So they have some sort of competitive advantage typically that lets them earn superior returns per dollar invested. So what we're looking for is those sorts of businesses that have lots of opportunities over time to grow their earnings through organic growth. And that's what we would describe as a high quality business. We think we're reasonably good at identifying businesses that will grow their earnings from point A to point B over the next 5 to 10 years and beyond. And then we set about establishing a reasonable valuation framework around that. So we don't want to overpay for those businesses because you can turn a great company into a poor investment by severely overpaying for that investment. And so we have a range of valuations per company, ranging from fair to attractive, that we would be willing to buy in at, given the quality attributes, the growth attributes, the return on capital attributes, depending on the business. And so we currently run two funds. We run a fund that's been going since inception, 11 and a half years now, and it's delivered a little under 16% per annum since we started. And then we launched a second fund, the AusCap X20 Australian Equities Fund, in December of last year.
And I have to say congratulations. That long short fund, you say, just under 16. I think I have it as 15.8% since inception. That's a great compound annual growth return. The last year being up 22%. The last 5 years up 15.3%. All the way around, it's a great performance. So well done over those years. It's fantastic performance. What's the funds under management of the firm at the moment, Tim?
We have about 360 mil at the moment. Primarily individuals invested, so high net worth and retail investors that have come direct to us. We don't have any institutional mandates at this point, but you know, we have hundreds of investors that I think, like what we do and follow us pretty actively. They read all our newsletters. They follow us on our webcasts. And it's a very loyal investor base that we're very thankful for.
And how are you feeling about the market at the moment? We've just come back through reporting season. I know we delayed this until after reporting season. How have you fared through that, and how are you feeling about markets?
Reporting season was very good for us. A lot of the businesses that we hold are doing extremely well. We were quite bullish 6 months ago because we thought that expectations across the market were quite pessimistic. And, you know, we had a reasonable idea that a lot of the companies that we hold were doing pretty well, and that wasn't being priced in by market participants. Obviously, things have moved a reasonable way since then, with a very strong last 3 or 4 months. So expectations for future earnings now, I think, are more in line with our expectations. So we've gone from attractively priced to reasonably close to fair value, I think, for the stocks that we hold, and the same can probably be said for the market more broadly. I think it's slightly more nuanced from this point. I'm sure we'll get into, you know, what creates opportunities and risks in the market, but one of the things that we really focus on is understanding the likelihood of different outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people talk about not predicting the future. Predicting the future involves trying to determine what single path an economy or market will take, and that's a folly. But what you can do is you can look at all of the past evidence over recent decades to understand what outcomes are more likely and what outcomes are less likely based on extrapolating the past. And so to use the example from recent history, 6 months ago, the market had expectations for retail stocks and consumer discretionary stocks that were very bearish. And the reason they were very bearish was a lot of analysts had assumed that revenues were going to decline across the consumer discretionary space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you know the data, you know that that is exceptionally unlikely. If we look at the data since the ABS, the Australian Bureau of Statistics, started recording it back in 1959, all the way through to today, and you look at rolling 12-month performance of discretionary spend, so that's spend stripping out the spend on food and alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
During that entire period, consumer discretionary spend has only gone backwards once. That was for a very brief window in June of 2020. And the reason for that was for close to a quarter, we were literally stopped from spending in the way that we typically had.
Mm-hmm. Right?
So if you know that, then you also know that it is very unlikely that you will see in the current environment a whole lot of sectors where revenues are going backwards, i.e. we're spending less year than we were last year, let alone one that has close to full employment, strong wage growth. Yes, we've had rising interest rates, but we've got very strong population growth, and population growth and inflation are ultimately the determinants of what happens to spend over time. And so when you get the market pricing in what is an exceptionally low probability outcome as its base case, in this case on the bearish side, then you often see a contraction in multiples, but you also get the market pricing in earnings that we think are unrealistically low. And so that's what's played out. So fast forward, you've seen earnings expectations lift across those retail names. Multiples also lift, and that delivers what looks like an exceptionally strong return. But it was the opportunity created by unreasonably low expectations in the first place. So if we now sit here today and think about, well, where might there be a risk or an opportunity, we think a source of risk is expectations around interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
Because we sit here, and as I said, we're close to full employment. Some of the lead indicators are pointing lower, so that's most certainly a negative. But at the same time, you've got very strong population growth. You've got a federal government that's most likely in surplus. You've got close to record terms of trade, printing some extraordinary figures each month from our net export industry. Or industries. We've got still close to record number of job vacancies. You've got a very strong backdrop for that set of assumptions that somehow we're going to get, you know, 2, 3, 4 interest rate cuts in the next 12 months.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think that if the market starts to and continues to price in significant rate cuts, that looks exceptionally unlikely in this environment. We've also got rising house prices and stock markets and record high. None of those factors feel to us like it's an environment where we should expect a significant number of rate cuts.
Mm-hmm.
So if markets keep pricing as such, that creates a risk when, you know, it becomes a little more obvious that that's a very unlikely outcome.
So what sort of companies and sectors, given that sort of view, do you favour or say, look, I'm really trying to avoid these sort of sectors because of that?
So we don't tilt our portfolio too much because of, you know, risks or opportunities, because we're focused more on owning great businesses for long periods. The biggest opportunity you get in life is to own great assets for long periods.
Mm-hmm.
Most people understand that intuitively when it comes to an asset like property. I own a great property in a great location with a great aspect, and you're going to do well over time. But part of the reason they do so well in property is they don't get marked every single day as to what people think that property might be worth.
Yep.
Right.
And they get dislocated from it during the down points.
Exactly. And so, you know, that's what makes markets a little different to residential property. So we think we own a selection of terrific businesses. To the extent that some get priced reasonably aggressively, assuming what we think is an overly optimistic outlook, then we will trim a little bit. And similarly, to the extent that the dislocation presents us with an opportunity, then we will tilt the portfolio a little more heavily towards those opportunities. But we don't make wholesale changes, and that's fairly obvious. We run a high conviction fund in the long short fund. A high conviction fund means that, you know, you have a reasonable concentration at the top end of the fund. So our top 10 holdings, I think at the moment, make up 55% of the portfolio. The top 20 make up, I think, 82%. And so, you know, our returns are dictated by what happens to a relatively small number of what we think are really great companies. So we don't swing that around a whole lot, but we certainly will trim or add selectively if we get, you know, opportunities that we think make more sense or risks that we think aren't being priced in.
And Tim, am I right in thinking the long short fund has the ability to go short? At the moment, you have no shorts on. What should we be? Am I right in thinking you've got no shorts?
Yeah, we have no shorts.
So should we be saying that, you know, has he pushed all his chips into the middle here and thinks that it's a belter of a market? Or is it just, well, you know, you can't find anything compelling to short, or you think it's not worth it?
Yeah, hindsight's sometimes a wonderful thing in many, many respects. But in relation to the naming of the AusCap Long Short Australian Equities Fund, we probably didn't name that properly. It's never really had considerable shorts. I mean, I think since we started, it's been about 100% long, by maybe not 10% short. So it's had relatively low short interest. And over the life of the fund, we really have become less and less interested mm-hmm. in the short side. So we don't take any leverage on the long side anymore, and we're very, very, very selective about ever having a short. And the reason for that is pretty simple. Since we started the fund, our longs have generated 99.7% of their returns.
Mm-hmm.
So the shorts, which have probably occupied 30 to 40% of my mental capacity over that time,
yep.
have generated 0.3% of the returns.
Mm-hmm.
If we weren't clever enough to realise that we should spend more time doing what generates the returns and less time doing what generates very little, then I think our investors would be worried. So our conclusion from the last decade plus is that we will short very, very selectively, if at all, on a go-forward basis. So everyone should really think about this fund as a high-conviction fund. That's what it is. That's what it's always been.
Yes.
There's no changing the spots, because you can go back and look at our shorts over time and you'll realise that they've been pretty low, if at all, for the duration of the fund.
Yeah. I had a fund manager once describe the use of shorts, and I really liked it. You know, they're a keen rugby union supporter. And they said it's a little bit like the ability to be able to kick left foot. You don't want to rely on it and use it every time, but it's handy every now and again. So I actually liken that in someone's portfolio. The ability to short is every now and again, if you have to get yourself out of trouble, you can use that. And it's handy. It comes, but you don't want to be relying on that as your standard. Let's talk about some of the positions you have. And this one will be interesting, because by the time this episode goes to air, we'll have released an episode regarding GLP-1 and Ozempic that we did with Dr. Craig Colley, the healthcare fund manager for Regal, where we sort of dug in deep about GLP-1, Ozempic, this sort of drug, and Novo Nordisk, and Eli Lilly. One of your positions in the portfolio is ResMed. And of course, ResMed's had some trading action based on the premise or thesis that, you know, everybody is going to have access to this wonder drug that allows them to drop 15 to 20% of their body weight. If you lose that sort of weight, you may not need a ResMed machine because you don't snore as much, and the risk factors associated with that. How are you thinking about ResMed and the risk in markets for devices like that from something like Ozempic?
Yeah, ResMed's a company that we've watched for a long time but not held until we got an opportunity recently as a result of the sell-off. It relates to the conversation we were just having really about risks and opportunities, because immediately the market started discounting ResMed as though GLP-1s were going to be in the end of the, you know, positive trajectory for ResMed's earnings over many, many years now. And there were a few things that we knew were unlikely to happen. The first is just understanding the market size that ResMed faces. They've penetrated a very, very small part of the market. So our initial premise was reasonably straightforward. Here's a great company with great metrics, great return on capital.
So these are people manufacturing, for people not familiar with the company, Australian company, with masks that is sleep apnea.
That's sleep apnea, and the sleep apnea market is very underpenetrated. The second was that people were assuming that a greater awareness of risks around obesity and trying to solve the issues around obesity would automatically be negative for companies like ResMed. So GLP-1s are not that new. ResMed's been undertaking a study for the last couple of years, I think involving around 500,000 patients. And the early indications from that study are that actually the use of GLP-1s has increased the use of ResMed-related products. They get better utilization from clients that are also on GLP-1s, maintaining at a better rate their use of the sleep apnea devices. And that's probably not surprising, given they're obviously motivated to fix the health issues they've got as a result of their obesity. But the second is that we're, as a result, seeing better outcomes initially, admittedly. We're seeing better outcomes from patients that adopt a dual strategy, so don't just rely on the drugs as their sole remedy. And so, you know, all of a sudden, in a pretty short period of time, I think the market has gone from assuming that this would be reasonably disastrous for a company like ResMed to, well, actually, potentially, this is not only not disastrous, but it might even be supportive of what ResMed is trying to do. So, you know, we were very comfortable with the price that we managed to buy in at in the last 6 months. The healthcare companies have been extremely expensive for the best part of the last decade. The main reason for that in the last 5 or 6 years is interest rates were at zero. And as a result, companies that didn't look like they were exposed to the economic cycle, you know, in an Excel spreadsheet, look like they should trade on 50 times earnings. And many of them have for, you know, that whole period where we had extremely low interest rates. We would be surprised if you didn't see more opportunities emerge in the healthcare space now that interest rates are back in what we would consider to be sort of a normal range. You know, ResMed was the first such opportunity that obviously, you know, resulted from a degree of panic in relation to how GLP-1s would affect their business. It doesn't appear that that's likely to be as significant as people initially expected. So, you know, it's very happily a core holding for us in the fund at the moment.
And Tim, how are you thinking about lithium? Or are you thinking about it at all?
Yeah, so we have owned Mineral Resources for a long time now, and it had become the biggest position in the fund towards the end of 2022, having rallied from $13 to over $90, so probably not a surprise that it had become a large position for us. At that point in time, a large part of the valuation was being attributed to lithium, and we saw lithium inventory starting to build in China and South Korea, two very important markets for lithium spodumene. We started to see a build-up of batteries in different markets as well, and we started to see the price turn down. And so we got concerned enough that we reduced that position very substantially at the back end of 2022. And unsurprisingly, we saw prices decline very considerably over 2023. We think that decline has now largely washed through, and you're starting to see some supportive price action for the various lithium components, be it spodumene or carbonate hydroxide, which suggests to us that destocking has taken place. Some of the higher cost lithium producers are gradually receding from the market, and over time we expect the demand story to take over again. And the demand and supply equation is such that if demand growth plays out as we anticipate over the next decade, it will be very hard for supply to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
So we have been using the sell-off to increase our exposure over the last 3 to 4 months in mineral resources, but we've also added Pilbara, who have demonstrated incredible balance sheet conservatism, really, to have $1.5 to $2 billion of cash on balance sheet, not get involved in all of the hype and acquisitive action that we saw, a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. And so that puts them in an incredible place today to take advantage of both organic and inorganic opportunities with a large degree of uncontracted supply that they can offer to large, long-term buyers that will be increasingly worried about where they secure lithium supply for, putting into batteries, over the course of the next couple of years. So, we are back in the enthusiastic camp about the lithium producers. We would be wary of developers and those that just have lithium in the ground, because what's become obvious is that it's very difficult to develop a lot of these projects and develop these mines, and it's far more costly than we were assuming that it would be only a little while ago. And again, that's to the natural benefit of the existing producers, which is why you see us in two of the better listed businesses, I think, in that space. The second part of mineral resources is obviously that they're about to shift from being a very low-cost iron ore producer a very high-cost iron ore producer in small supply to a much lower-cost producer with far greater supply in the next 6 months. And, if iron ore prices are anything like that today, circa $100 a ton, that's going to be an incredibly profitable business for them. They will be generating enormous amounts of cash within the operation that was low. So we think the market is probably underappreciating the value has been created by the iron ore project that they've got up and running slowly in a incredibly short period of time. That's due to produce first in June of this year. So it's a very, very significant project and has the potential to generate billions of dollars of EBITDA for that business on an annual basis.
Now, talking about iron ore, and you touched on it with lithium, you can't go past a conversation on China when you talk about that. I know many years ago you had some strong views on China. What's your current thinking about China insofar as affects the Australian industries that you've discussed?
Yeah, well, China is obviously facing a myriad of problems at the moment. They have a lot of financial leverage in the system. We think that they have overbuilt, particularly in residential property, but also on the infrastructure front. And if you overbuild for a period, then you need a natural underbuild for a period after that. Obviously, a lot of that construction is very dependent on iron ore. We've been quite surprised at how resilient the iron ore market is, which suggests to us that perhaps domestic supply in China was a lot greater than we had previously anticipated, and that will be the really high-cost supply that comes out of the market first. We have to remember that the Australian iron ore players are at the very bottom of the cost curve. But China's also facing a number of other problems. They've got an aging and declining population. They've found it very, very difficult to rectify that despite the removal of the one-child policy and incentives to try and encourage people to have more than one child, couples to have more than one child. And now you've got obviously the concentration of control in the president, and you know, the effects that that might have on the entrepreneurial spirit, which I think really drives development in a lot of countries, is yet to be seen. But obviously the crackdown on various industries probably hasn't helped. So, you know, we are certainly cautious on the outlook for China. We're cautious on the outlook for iron ore. You know, that's part of the reason that we don't have any significant exposure to the iron ore players that are very dependent on that one.
And Tim, one of the holdings you have also that I found a little unusual when I was reading your monthly update is the Charter Hall REIT, which is a little bit unusual, I would have thought, for a fund like yours to be holding that. But I suspect you're seeing some sort of price action and readjustment of the REIT ahead of the market. Maybe you can comment a little bit on that.
Yeah, so the Charter Hall vehicle that we own is the Charter Hall Retail REIT. So within real estate, we are cautious on office. There's an excess of supply and a severe vacancy problem. We also think the cap rates that are being implied by the market are still not sufficiently high to warrant investment.
Industrial, they're almost cash rates in many cases.
They are almost cash rates, yeah. In industrial, you have cap rates, but they've got incredible growth in rental income streams as they renew leases with, you know, 30-40% jumps.
So do you believe we're looking at some deals where they're, you know, implied 100% jumps in, if you're talking about Sydney industrial property, last mile or infill, they're talking about 100% rental increases?
Well, it's asset specific. In some cases that is happening, we don't.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? Like, how can companies, like I would have thought, rent for most of these companies is a pretty big operating expense, and to have that double and still be in business, that's pretty amazing, I think.
Yeah, well, some of these assets are monopoly assets.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we forget. We would put a lot of the retail assets in the same bucket. So we don't own a lot of industrial, but we do think the cap rates being implied within the retail space are attractive. In fact, they're not that dissimilar to cap rates in retail, in high-quality retail, back in 2006, 2007, when obviously the cash rate was higher than where it is today, considerably higher than where it is today. So on something like the Charter Hall retail rate, the implied cap rate is in the mid-sixes, low to mid-sixes. And it has an incredible tenant base of very highly regarded lessors. And, the total return that's being offered by that REIT, given where its implied cap rate is today, we think is attractive as a total return proposition for the risk that we're taking. So it's not the only retail REIT we own. We also own Homeco Daily Needs REIT, who we think even have even more upside than the Charter Hall retail REIT. Again, their tenant mix is unbelievable. They remain 99% plus tenanted. You can't get to 100% because you always have some tenants enrolled. You're losing one tenant, you're doing the fit out for the next. So you're never at 100%, but they have been at 99% occupancy for as long as I can remember. And you, in that situation, you have a 6 to 6.5% cap rate. We think earnings are going to grow at 3 to 5% per annum. And there's development upside because their sites are less than 40% utilized as we sit here today. And then the management are very incentivized to recycle capital sensibly. So we think for both of those assets, you're probably getting a 9 to 12% total return with relatively low risk, with some decent upside from the way the managers manage those assets. From our perspective, that's an attractive total return for the risk involved in those
assets. And in that retail space, is there any subsectors that you prefer, i.e. is it sort of large city metro-based malls or regional big box or any themes in there?
Yeah, we still prefer large format retail. You tend to find that the quality of the tenants is higher. They're typically large national, large multinational or listed companies. They have good diversification. So there's very little risk that you'll have a tenant that's not going to pay its rent. They're very profitable stores for all the tenants. That's very important. And we think they are considerably under-rented. So across HomeCo's portfolio, they're currently renting it out at about $360 a square metre. If you compare that to Vicinity, Vicinity's over $900. As a result, these stores are very profitable for their tenants. And so you are seeing at the end of leases very considerable jumps in the starting rent for the next lease for the same tenant, right? So their re-leasing spreads have accelerated to above 6%. So normally they would get 3 to 4% per annum in rental increases. A lot of the struggling assets around the country, when they have to re-sign a lease, you see them give up an incentive or you see them reset the lease to a lower rate for the start of the next lease than they finished on the previous lease.
Mm-hmm.
Well, HomeCo Dunedin's REIT is in the opposite situation. A tenant gets to the end of a lease and then they've got to have a big jump, similar to industrial but to less a degree, for the start of the new lease. That is telling you that those assets are A, in demand, and B, represent very good value for the tenants. And that increases the total return that we expect from that pool of assets over time. So as I said, we expect them to deliver a 9 to 12% total return, but with upside, as you see a lot of these tenants renew their leases at considerably higher rates.
We've talked about large format retail there, and I was reminded when doing research for this episode with Tom Oriel, who helps put the podcast together with me, about your conviction around JB Hi-Fi back when sort of Amazon was coming into the market and, you know, it was the sky was falling and, you know, any retail stock was being absolutely pounded, and JB Hi-Fi, and you came on the podcast with very high conviction saying, oh, JB Hi-Fi is a great company, we've got high conviction in it, and you've turned out to be very right on that. So, you know, good call there, and also, you know, your knowledge in that retail space is obviously very strong.
Well, I can't take the credit for that. The JB Hi-Fi team can take the credit for that. But there are two things that they do remarkably well. One is their cost of doing business is the lowest of any major electronics retailer globally, which is somewhat extraordinary. Some of those retailers are to 10 times their size in some of the bigger markets. And the second thing is they have worked out a way to appeal to the value-conscious customer that is very difficult for an online-only player to compete with. And that is the fact that you can go into store and you can ask for a discount. And I know categorically every single time for any product I've ever purchased at JB Hi-Fi, I go into the store, there's the listed price, and then I say, what's the best price you can do? And they will immediately cut the price that they can give to you, with a few exceptions, but the exceptions are
probably Apple.
A few and far between, you might have hit one of them there. And so what that means they can do is they can scrape data from Amazon every day and they can afford to be $1, $5, $10 more expensive, because for the really value-conscious customer in the domestic market, they know that they can go into JB Hi-Fi and they will get a better price than the price that Amazon has on its website. And so if you are not, as Amazon, appealing to the most value-conscious customer, who are you winning, is the question you've got to ask. And so that's been a very successful strategy. On top of that, you've got the great issue around delivery. They get to use their hundreds of stores as mini outlet distribution centers for online. If you've got a problem with a product, you can take it back to a store. You know who you're sending it back to. You know they're not trying to operate out of two distribution centers for a country the size of Australia. So there's a lot of natural competitive advantages that they have in their pocket. But you know, winning over that critical customer is something that Amazon have been able to do against JB Hi-Fi in the same way that they've done it in lots of other geographies.
Yep. Tim, this reporting season that's just gone by, it would seem that every company had an answer for or an angle or a strategy on AI. Every startup that I've looked at for the last 9, 6 months, 12 months has been, you know, an AI this or that. How are you thinking about artificial intelligence and the effect it may have on companies going forward? You know, is this a beat up or is this something that's going to be transformational?
Well, I think it's far more likely to be transformational than a beat up. In the same way that when the internet came out, it was obvious that that was going to have a very, very large impact on society. And to the extent that it could impact the companies that you already hold in your portfolio, I think it's certainly worthwhile thinking very closely about that. I listened to a podcast only a few days ago, actually, from Jensen Huang, the founder of NVIDIA.
Mm-hmm.
And he was highlighting some of the different applications that AI might have. I mean, NVIDIA are the leader in software and hardware, really, for the AI.
Which podcast was that? Was that the Acquired podcast?
The Acquired podcast.
Terrific podcast, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, the applications are almost endless. And, the ability for industries to transform themselves as a result of mm-hmm. computational power is a lot to take in. So you need to be aware of how that's going to impact companies that you hold, and we spend a reasonable amount of time doing that. As to whether there will be a huge number of AI winners that you'll be able to monetize, you know, history is actually would suggest that that's going to be a little bit more difficult.
Mm.
There are a lot of transformational changes that occur over time. As a result, people get very excited about the change.
Then trying to make money out of them is very difficult.
A lot of capital gets attracted to the space, and obviously NVIDIA now becoming one of the largest companies in the world, that will only be more so in the AI arena. And obviously lots of capital competing and trying to develop AI in ways that will be able to be monetized. That competition actually erodes any super profits that you otherwise might experience. So unless there's one very clear leader, at the moment there is a clear leader, but let's see whether other firms can catch up. Because the reason it's printing so much money is obviously its gross margins are extraordinary. So if that's sustainable, then maybe it continues to be the clear leader. But its history would suggest that when you attract a lot of capital to an arena, then you know there aren't a huge number of financial winners out of that. We're reminded of all the way back in the 1910s and 1920s. I think in the start of that century, there were 3,000 auto companies after the Model T Ford came out within 15 years. And of those, only a couple survived today, and the rest of them have lost a lot of money for their investors. So you need to be very careful when investing in businesses that that are very exciting. But
And trying to ride a big wave, you know, and I think of, you know, solar panels, for instance, and people are very excited about that. Try to find someone who's made any money out of solar panels after the Chinese flooded the market. I also think of, it was very obvious, you know, during the dot-com boom and, you know, Kodak inventing digital photography, it was very obvious that digital photography was going to be a huge thing. But then try to explain to someone or have the foresight back in 1999 that, yeah, there's going to be this company where, you know, your wife and all the friends take pictures and everybody shares all their information and personal data. And, you know, there's going to be, you know, Facebook and these companies that are going to profit from digital photography in the future. You would have no hope, I think, of picking that. So it's very hard to ride some of those waves. I went back and listened to one of the other podcasts we did with you, and we spoke a little bit about crypto.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you were a fair naysayer in that, you know, I can't get my head around Bitcoin and the value add of it. Where do you sit on that at the moment?
Well, I think my view hasn't changed. You know, it's very difficult to understand what gives Bitcoin its legitimacy. And I think it might have been on that podcast that we talked about the fact that, you know, well, it's very difficult to ascertain why it should have legitimacy, in which case you just get, while the amount of Bitcoin itself might be limited, you just see the emergence of a whole lot of other coins. Mm-hmm. And pretty shortly thereafter, we saw the emergence of a whole lot of other coins until the market eventually gets saturated. You know, from my perspective, it still looks like it's the domain of speculators largely. It's not really behaving as a store of value. It's obviously the preferred currency for those that are implementing ransomware attacks, which suggests to me that you're probably more likely to see regulation over time or increased regulation and supervision of it. So, you know, from our perspective, it's just something that we don't understand. We can't put a value on it. So we would just choose to pass on it. We don't need to have a view on crypto. So we don't. But, I come back to my initial proposition. What gives a monetary currency value is the fact that the country that's implementing it has the ability to tax its residents.
Yes.
you don't have a source of authority for Bitcoin.
Well, those who are going back to episode 53 or 9 will see that you get an A for consistency. So well done, the exact same view then or now as then. Before we round out the conversation on OzCap and your investments, are there any other points you'd like to leave our listeners before I follow up with a couple of other round-out questions?
Well, for those that have followed us for some time, it's probably worth touching on the X20 fund and the reason that came about, because
sure.
It also invests in Aussie equities, and we've been investing in mid caps and small caps primarily in the existing fund since we started it. So the two funds can look very similar, but there are problems for some investors with concentrated funds, high conviction funds, in that they do have a lot of capital tied up in certain stocks and certain sectors, and that can result in volatility. And when you're an investor in funds, you need to choose funds that match your own appetite and profile. And so if you're going to be unhappy that a fund deviates materially from an index, even though it looks nothing like, then you should choose a fund that looks more similar to the index. So recognizing that was the primary reason that we launched the X20 fund. It's a vanilla fund, so there's no shorting. It doesn't complicate investing in Aussie equities. Its universe is really the 21st largest company down to the 300th, so we ignore the ASX 20. The ASX 20 makes up about 57.5% of the market and really doesn't excite us a whole lot. Earnings growth is what drives your total return over time. So if you think about the total return, say, over the last 23 years since 2000, your total return is going to be determined by the dividend yield plus the earnings growth that you've seen in your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
Right? All of the other things that you think matter over the short term are just noise when you stretch out the time horizon. And the proof is in the pudding. If you look at which index has performed the best over the last 23 years, it's the mid-cap index. Right? It's delivered over 800% as a total return in the Aussie market. And you compare that to the ASX 20 or the All Ords, they've done very similar. And they've done a little over 500%.
Mm-hmm.
And then you look at the Small Ords and it's done about 200%. Right, so that order of magnitude in difference between those return profiles is not a function of whether the mid caps are suddenly in favor or out of favor, because that might move the dial 20%, but it's obviously not moving the dial to the extent that you see those big differences. Right? What's really driven that outperformance over time has been the fact that the mid cap index has delivered far stronger earnings growth. So if you think about earnings growth being a combination of, total return has been a combination of earnings growth and dividend yield, that equation has been most powerful in the mid-cap universe, and we expect that that will continue. And so what we've done with the X20 index is we've said, well, we're going to invest in that universe, the 21st down to the 300th, and then we're doing something that's a little bit different. We're going to be sector aware, because what we've realized over time is actually the reason the fund has moved on occasion in different directions or to different degrees than the index is the fact that we might be overweight one sector and very underweight another sector. And if the sector we're overweight is doing well and the sector we're underweight is doing poorly, then we'll perform spectacularly. If the reverse is true, then we'll obviously underperform. And
in a relative sense.
In a relative sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And some investors don't like that. So we've been overweight consumer stocks since the fund started, really because there are some fantastic businesses with long runways for earnings growth over time in that space. And we've been underweight mining for the worst reason. And as a result, if mining's doing well and consumer stocks are doing poorly, even if it's just a sentiment-driven move, then we will underperform. And we appreciate that some investors don't like seeing that. So in the new fund, we're sector aware. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to isolate our stock picking ability and make any outperformance or underperformance the result of whether we pick the right names. And so we're comparing ourselves to the X20 index. It's a much more balanced index than the All Ords. It has less resources and less materials. So it's got a far more equal sector weighting than the All Ords.
It's an interesting debate in the US at the moment with a lot of managers wanting to be on the equal weighting index rather than the actual index itself, sure. Given that it's all been driven by five stocks.
Exactly. I'm sure that's a big debate. But and so we'll be within 5% of the index weight so that we're really removing the influence of whether we're overweight or underweight a sector, and we're just bringing it back to our stock picking ability. So it's a vanilla fund. It has a long only type fund fee structure, which I think will also please investors. And you know, one of the questions we got asked is, if you're being sector aware, does that mean you're active? Will you actually be able to outperform? Well, hopefully that question has been answered a little bit. The fund's been going for 3 months, and it's done 4.5% above the index, being sector aware. So it's still an active fund. It'll still have a very high active share, but we're trying to generate consistent outperformance rather than, you know, big moves and then potential retracements. So for people that prefer that sort of approach, we now have a fund that suits them. And I've always said, it's very important if you're investing in managed funds for you to agree with the way the manager is thinking about investing in your capital. And if it doesn't matter how good their return profile looks, if what they're saying doesn't accord with your natural set of beliefs around investing, then find managers that do invest the way you would like them to invest, because otherwise you're just going to leave yourself with a headache at some point down the track.
Tim, thanks very much for your time. It's been great having you. A couple of other questions here, but covering off that fund that way, it's great. And to have you on the show for a third time, thanks for joining us. Right, little curly one here. I'll give you a little notice. Obviously, you manage money for clients in the Australian market, which is a good out for you on this question. If you had a spare dollar that you couldn't invest in your funds, or let's call it in an Australian equities fund, where would you invest it today?
It's a question with a very, very boring answer. And I think investors would do very well abiding by this. And that is, don't be afraid to sit in cash and wait patiently. For some reason, cash burns holes in people's pockets.
Mm-hmm. Massively.
I generally advertise when, or publicly say to our investors, when to my exposure in the fund. And it's typically during periods of market stress, because I see that there's lots of value offering fund, and the only way I invest in Aussie equities is through funds. And outside of that, I'm very, very happy to sit building cash for the next opportunity. Mm-hmm. Because if you patiently do that, you're still invested. I've got a very significant investment. I'm one of the largest investors in our two funds. And so, you know, I have exposure to great businesses over time, to those great assets that you want to own for long periods of time. But I also know that over the next 30, 40, 50 years, all of which I expect to be running the AusCap funds, there will be regular dislocations, and they will present incredible opportunities to get involved in the funds, or if you're investing outside of that, to buy some great companies at great prices, or buy great properties at great prices. And normally in those moments of stress, there are so few people with cash that they can invest that very few, even if they recognize the opportunity, very few can take advantage of it. So you want to be in a position where you can take advantage of it. And right now you're getting paid, you know, a little over 4%.
It's very well to wait. It's a great return for a free option.
Yes.
Thank you, and thank you for that and the podcast. And as a thank you, one of the things that we're trying to build in the podcast, I've been terrible at this because I keep forgetting right at the end, is as a thank you to you and coming on and giving us a lot of your thoughts and great expertise, we'd love to give you the opportunity to plug a not-for-profit or a charitable cause that some of our listeners might want to look up and may contribute or support in that way to it. So if you've got one of those, that'd be fantastic if you want to give it a plug.
Sure. Well, the one I'm going to choose is one that we only became aware of about a year ago, actually as a result of the Australian Fund Manager Awards, and that is the Mirabelle Foundation. So they assist children that have been abandoned by their parent or parents as a result of illicit drug use, and are now being cared for by sort of extended family members, often grandparents and the like, and they provide support services to the children, to the carers, and the stories that you know emerge from their support are extraordinary. The impact on those children's lives is incredible. So we've only had a little bit to do with them to this point, but I, you know, we are quite big on trying to support organisations. We dedicate a certain amount of our revenue every year to different causes, and certainly we think that it's hard to find a more inspirational story than the work that they do with those children and those extended family members that are now caring for children that you know, they're direct children. So if you want to look up a foundation, you know, I'd certainly encourage you to look up the Mirabelle Foundation.
The Mirabelle Foundation, and people can just find that online. How's that spelled?
M-I-R-A-B-E-L.
Fantastic. Tim Carlton, thanks for joining us Inside the Rope.
Thank you for listening to Inside the Rope with David Clark. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can connect with David by visiting codacapital.com. Any views expressed in this recording represent the personal opinions of the speaker and do not represent the view of any other party. If this recording contains reference to any financial products, that reference does not constitute advice or recommendation and may not be relied upon. Listeners in Australia are encouraged to visit www.moneysmart.gov.au to obtain information regarding financial advice and investments.